Welcome to the Dive into Reiki podcast. I'm Natalie, and together we will enjoy a series of conversations that explore the journey of Reiki practitioners and teachers from all lineages. 100% Reiki-focused stories, 100% human. Hi, and welcome to a new episode of the Dive into Reiki podcast. Today, my guest is Robert Fuston. I had not heard of Robert until a few months ago when someone referred me to him and his wonderful book, Reiki Transmission of Light. And I was so grateful when he said yes to come and have a conversation on the podcast. Robert Fuston is based in Kentucky. He's a state licensed and nationally board certified acupuncturist and Chinese herbalist, a Reiki master, author, an internationally recognized researcher and teacher of Reiki. He started his training in Usui Shiki Reiki Ryoho in 1996, and his desire to understand the movement of Reiki from Japan to the West set him on a path of research in Hawaii Takata and her role in bringing Reiki from Japan to the US. With a Master of Library and Information Science and a Postmaster Certificate of Advanced Graduate Study in Library and Information Science, he spent decades studying with and researching the Takata Masters in order to understand the preservation and, at times, alterations of the Reiki system. The results were published in an eye-opening book, which is the title I mentioned, Reiki Transmission of Light. And I have to say, I was a little bit surprised about a little bit of the Game of Thrones vibes that Mrs. Takata Succession story had around her. So I really think you're going to enjoy this interview a lot. And last but not least, Robert participated as a team member in the organization of the Historical Archives of the Reiki Alliance and as a member of the Hawaii Takata Archive team. So thank you so much, Robert, for saying yes.
Thanks for having me.
Perfect. And I start every podcast in the same way. How did you come in contact with Reiki the first time?
The first time was, in fact, I took a class before I ever had a treatment. So I got a book from a book club, and it was a free book. So I decided, you know, I'll just pick this one. I knew nothing about Reiki. And I got that book. And I didn't read it, you know, for like a good year. And I finally read the introduction, and then it said what it was about, but it said you had to be initiated by a Reiki master. And I knew there was no Reiki masters where I lived. So I thought, well, that's nice, but that's not going to happen for me. And just within that week, I kid you not, like there was a bulletin board, you know, with the old cork board. People would put like letters and business cards on it. And it said, Reiki class now available. It was at this tea shop I would visit. And so I could not believe it. And I called the number because I was like, wow, I just read about this. And this guy was visiting from Maui. And he said he would train me if I could bring 5 students to the class. So I convinced my friends to take this class. And not really knowing much about it myself, not into anything like this at all, but it just seemed like I was being led that way, you know, having just read that introduction to the book, just happens that this guy appears, you know, and I'm like, this is an opportunity and I'll take it. So that's what I did. And I've been practicing ever since. And that was in 1996.
Wow, that's actually 10 years exactly before I started, in a very weird way, and also without having a Reiki session before.
Right.
So you did, and again, probably like around 90% of people who take Reiki 1 don't really move forward, or they keep the practice to themselves.
Right.
What drove you to deepen and go into Reiki Masters and keep on training?
That's a good question. I practiced for 6 months, first degree, and it just never occurred to me. It never even occurred to me that there was a second degree. I just didn't really think about it. And finally, after about, you know, month 5 or so, I started thinking, I'm practicing this stuff. And I kind of remember, so I looked in the book, and sure enough, there was more stuff. It was about second degree. So I was like, oh, okay, so there's more. And it sounds interesting where you can do remote treatments and different kind of things. And so my teacher was gone. He was back in Maui. So I didn't know where to find a teacher. And I was at this metaphysical store. I was actually on the sidewalk outside the metaphysical store. And there was a sheet of paper taped to the glass window, display case window. And sure enough, it said Reiki class, or Reiki available, Reiki classes available. So I was like, wow. So I called that guy. And that guy said, well, I'm a new teacher, so I'm only teaching first degree. So I'll send you to my teacher. So I was like, wow, that's really good. So me and one of my other friends who took first degree with me 6 months prior, we went and got trained in second degree. And at that time, back in the day, you had to bring your first degree certificate because, this teacher didn't know me. So I had to bring my first degree certificate to her so she would know I really was trained, first degree. So did that, and she trained us both in second degree, and I didn't really have any plans on going to the teaching level. But life throws you curveballs. I thought I was going to stay up in Northern Ohio or move up to Michigan, and that didn't happen. So I instead decided I was going to move to South Carolina. And I'm thinking South Carolina, I've lived my whole life in Ohio. I don't think there's going to be any Reiki teachers down there. And so I was discussing this with my second degree teacher, and she's like, well, I'll train you before you go. And I was like, oh, wow, that's awesome. And it wasn't like too long after my second degree. And the only reason we did it, and it was just like maybe, I'm guessing 3 or 4 months. I'd have to look. And it was simply because I was going to move away. But her and I kept in contact for years. I mean, through email, and whenever I come to Ohio, we'd visit. We'd have Reiki share still. I spent a lot of time with her, actually. So that's how, as soon as I got to South Carolina, of course, then I wanted to find more Reiki people, But at first I was like, oh, there's nobody here. But then I found people. So then I was hanging out with them, and we were practicing together, Reiki shares. So it just was like, it was just like a continuous thing when I started practicing in 96. It just kept going.
It's beautiful. No, I'm thinking also like in the late 90s, there were not even that many people like practicing Reiki. So to find them, when you found them, you were like, stay with me.
Because I mean, I think, there was no, there's not hardly any web pages. I mean, the internet's not what it is today. I think Google came out around 96, if I'm not mistaken. And, there wasn't many web pages. So there was nothing really to have to show. And so it wasn't like you could connect with people online very well.
Yeah, no, it's as you say, it was going to a store or like a yoga studio or something like that.
Yeah.
There was a beauty of synchronicity in it. It still happened with Google, but it's easier. It's less of a good story. Like my story is literally a Google Reiki, right?
Right. Yeah. It's a different world.
So there is obviously, and you're trained as a researcher, so that makes sense. But like a lot of us, when I took my first training, there were things that felt like a little bit like didn't fit with me, but I said, well, that's the training, that's it. Yet you are like, hold on, I want to know how Mrs. Takata actually practiced, right? So what awoke that? The research in you, what was that spark?
Yeah, the spark was, when I was meeting the people in South Carolina, and we started to discuss, what we had learned, and it was very clear we all learned different things. And so I was like, well, this doesn't make sense. Like, there really wasn't many books. I think maybe there's like 3 or 4 books of Reiki back then. There really wasn't many. So it was very confusing. So I'm like, well, there's only one way to really solve this mystery, and that's to go back in my lineage and go back and try to find my teacher's teacher and all the way back. And that was proving difficult. So I thought, well, Mrs. Takata, has passed, but she trained masters. And if I find them, I can find out what she was teaching at that time. So that's what I did. So it took a while, but once I found one, and I can't remember, it might have been Fran Brown, might have been the first one I found. I But she put me in contact with a bunch of the other ones, even the ones that weren't teaching, like George Araki and stuff. So it was just one of those things where it's like you had to really put effort into finding them. And then once you found them, it's a cold call, or you can get an email, something like that.
Starting to, email was literally just starting. Like,
yeah. And I was, pretty new. I mean, this was 97. I was reaching out, and I think I made contact with Fran in 98. I'm not sure, but it took a while. But once that happened, the ball started rolling. And then, back then, it was just different because it wasn't like, you'd have to travel. So I had to travel, to meet some of these people and train with them. Fran was on the West Coast in California, and John Harvey Gray, another Takata master, was on the East Coast in Massachusetts. So it was literally coast to coast. So it was not as easy. And I spoke with Phyllis on the phone. I spoke with Shinobu Saito. I spoke with Harry Kaboy. I spoke with all these Takata masters. But I was like, well, I couldn't fathom, once I took John's classes, John Harvey Gray's classes, he had taught like Takata did, except he had added some chakra stuff in there. And so I was like, well, I really want strict Takata stuff. And I asked John on the break, I said, did Takata teach us? He's like, but everything else, was really strictly Takata based when I trained with him. That was in 2000. So I took first and second degree, retook it with him. And then I went to Fran Brown eventually, but through all these other people, learning. So, but lots of Takata masters, I was lucky because, I contacted probably at least half. And then out of the ones I couldn't get a hold of, like sometimes their daughter, if they had passed already, sometimes like their daughter or their family had like their teaching materials, and I literally got, their notes and things like that. So I could like compare all sorts of Takata master students information and see what they learned from Mrs. Takata. And then eventually, a long time later, I was invited to be part of the Hawaii Takata Sensei Archives. So it was a group of five of us, and we went down to where Phyllis was living at the time and went through all the Takata's material. And, there's all sorts of awesome stuff in there, just really amazing. And, of course, along the way, I picked up audio record Takata teaching first degree classes and second degree classes and bunch of stuff on the third degree she taught. It was just like being able to have a comprehensive knowledge of what Takata was teaching and when. It really was just fascinating to me, and that's really what I wanted, just for myself personally. But that's just kind of my path, was the Takata way.
Yeah. There are a couple of things I love. First, like without you and the team of the archive, those notes may have been lost. So they're really now 20 years after we realized how precious that work was. Yeah. And the other thing I like is, like, again, nowadays I got what I believe was Takata's histories of Reiki. And when I read your book of what Takata was actually teaching, it had nothing to do with what I learned. Right. And it was a lot closer to the traditional Japanese teaching.
Yeah, that's right.
So we are passing as Takata's Western, but it's not. She was actually a lot closer.
Right.
Just made a couple of tweaks for the US to understand it. She didn't.
Yeah.
And what I got was very, very, very removed. I said, yeah, she did that because the US, no, that wasn't her. So for me, reading your book and reading, I'm like, oh, but this history, like, I can see the tweaks, but it's actually very close to what I read on the tombstone, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. That's what was really surprising to me. Because my first lineage was like, I had a whole bunch of people between me and Takata in the lineage sheet. And at some point things got changed because what I received, was not, you know, really close. And but I was in the Takata lineage, right? So
yeah, me too.
Like, it was confusing. So once I started learning what Takata really taught, I was blown away. And I was like, wow, this stuff's really amazing and it's effective. And I wanted to find out what she was teaching and what she practiced, because, you know, her students had written books and things like that. And I mean, it wasn't like Takata tooting her own horn. Like, these students had experiences of getting healed by treatments with Mr. Takata. Takata had a system that was effective and simple. And it's like, wow, you know, I want to learn that. And so, if you know, if you practice that way, you see the results. And that's what people have to understand, that Takata, when she would treat people, she would treat them once a day. If it's a serious case, she would treat them twice a day. Daily for a month or 2 months or 3 months. You know, it's not just like one treatment a week or one treatment every other. It's that consistency. So if you want to see the results that Takata, you know, saw, you have to practice with diligence and with the frequency, you know, all of that. It's all important.
Which is in the precepts, Gyo o Hageme, right? It is part there as well. Practice diligently or work hard or whatever you want to translate it.
Right.
So it's no, and I think you said something beautiful, like simple and consistent, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now sometimes we expect the same result from like, oh, I can help this person with the health. I'm just giving them like 45 minutes once a week, or we're never going to have the same. And it's not about us. It's just literally like everybody needs that repetition that many.
That works. And, you know, that's how it works. And the more you practice, you know, the quicker, I would say, and it's true, the quicker the results would come, because more energy is able to flow through the practitioner at one time. So Takata, you know, had remarkable success. And a lot of people, you know, have had that experience where you do one treatment on somebody and something miraculous happens. And it's like, wow, you know, but we always go in with the treatment just thinking, hey, you know, we don't have any expectations. We don't know what's going to happen because it's not really up to us. All we do is we put our hands on the person, let the energy flow, let the Reiki flow through. That person's body is pulling it through us based upon how much they need in that particular area that we have our hands on. And then when we don't feel that pull anymore, we move. We move our hand position to the next position. And then there comes that pull. And, you know, it's like, so you know when to change because you can tell when that pull stops. And then you just move to the next position. So, yeah, it's so simple. It's so simple. So it's a very easy practice to learn and it's effective.
I think for us, at least in our culture, like the simplicity is the challenge, right? Because we don't that you can actually go deeper into true repetition. Also, I hated repetition before I did martial arts. I'm like, what do you mean I'm repeating the same thing? Because I wasn't aware of the subtleties. I think, and you as well, like you train and repeat and your protocol is even simpler than mine. So through repetition, I guess you can have these very sensitive subtleties of what happened.
Right. Yeah. The more you practice, the more sensitive you become. I mean, it's really that simple.
Yeah.
It's really that simple. And Takata, I'm trying to think how she phrased it. She phrased it like when you're first initiated in the first degree, you might have like, you know, 20% of the energy coming out of your hands because most of it, you know, she talked about the Reiki channel. So it comes through the top of the head and it goes all the way down to your little below your navel. And then it comes back up and out your arms and out your hands. So, but in the beginning, that lower tendon, that lower area below the navel, it's not as well developed. So most of the energy coming in is going to stick there. It's going to fill you up. And then you'll get the 20% excess will come out of your arms and your hands. But the more you practice, it will. Your tongue is more developed, so more energy comes out of your hands. And so she said, you know, by the time you do 40 years, like she was doing, she's like, you'll have just as much as me. But, you know, she practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced. And so it was remarkable consistency.
I'm also thinking no shortcuts, right? Like,
that's right. No shortcuts. Like, people love shortcuts. It's like,
no special symbol, no special attunement, no shortcut. Those only work for a little bit. They boost you and then you're back to where you were.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a practice. And so we, you know, practice the practice, and we allow that practice to change us. And we don't change the practice, like, you know, like, because yeah, that's the difference. It's like, do the practice and let it change you. And as don't change the practice to suit where you already are, because, you know, you want some shortcut, or you think, oh, I know better. Well, first do the practice and see if it works. And if you have something that works, go with that, you know. And if you don't, reevaluate. But, you know, if you have something that works, stick with it.
I love the way you just phrased that. Like, don't adapt the practice to where you are. Allow it to take you further. I think that is the first time I hear it like that, and it really resonates with me. So another part that I really love from your book, because obviously when I realized what I read from Mrs. Takata was like literally like, also I got a history that was like 4 lines long, right? Like, and then I read your book, and I had this, like, I realized Mrs. Takata again thought very differently from what I thought. And then the other thing I didn't know was the succession issue. And it's quite interesting because we don't talk. And for those of you who are not as familiar, when you refer to Phyllis, is Phyllis Lei Furumoto, which is Takata's granddaughter. And she was one of those, is 22? Now I may see me, maybe three masters that she trained. And there was another person who may have been also a successor. So there was like a little bit of a succession, Game of Thrones kind of action happening in 1980.
Game of Thrones.
I would be like the Reiki, Game of Reiki, whatever you like, you know? So... Yeah. You can explain, because for me, that is also explanation also of why also changes are happening a lot more. And also like why we have 150 lineages versus perhaps less.
Right.
Or styles.
Yeah. And this is just as true of a lot of systems out there, whether it's Reiki or yoga or whatever, you know, the teacher or the head teacher dies, they go into transition, and then there's squabbling. And it's like, really? I mean, we're supposed to be following the Reiki precepts. And I mean, legitimately, there probably was some confusion. And Phyllis did state, you know, to me and a group of people that, you know, originally Barbara Weber was trained. I mean, she was trained to be Takata's successor. But apparently they had a falling out very shortly before Mrs. Takata transitioned. So Phyllis doesn't dispute that the fact was that that's how it was meant to be originally. But other of Takata's master students had also been told that they would be successor, not just Phyllis and Barbara. So, yeah, but the problem becomes when I think we start behaving in un-Reiki-like behaviors. You know, one of our precepts is to be kind and not be angry. And when you have different factions of Reiki groups, like sending students to the other group's classes to heckle them, heckle the teacher. Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's terrible. It's like, wow, you wouldn't think this would happen in a practice that's all, you know, it's about spiritual development. It's about physical development. It's about, you know, being at peace. And how is this?
Nobody owns their practice. Like, you cannot
own it. But that's the thing, right? People, I mean, we are human and we have egos. And sometimes our egos get the best of us. And so, yeah, there was a lot of terrible things that happened. I won't write down or discuss openly because it's so bad that it's like, you know, I don't want to bring that kind of...
And don't give people any ideas about the heckling. Now we have like, oh, I'm going to send some people.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, you know, the things that were sent out. In fact, that's why some of the Takata masters stopped teaching because of the heckling. And I mean, it got worse than that. And so they just said, forget it. I'm not teaching. You know, I don't want to be associated with this kind of thing. You know, if this is what it's going to become. And it's really too bad that Mrs. Chow didn't live a little bit longer, I think, because her plans were, Barbara Weber was actually helping Mrs. Takata trademark that word Reiki, so to protect it, so that, you know, all sorts of variants later could pop up and kind of utilize that word for something different. but it didn't turn out that way. They were working on that. It didn't work out because they had the argument, but also because Takata transitioned so soon. But I kind of wonder if Takata had been around maybe another year or two, if some of the stuff would have been more or less resolved. But you'll never know. And maybe it was, it's how it turned out. And maybe it really shows how, where people were at that time with their practice. And, we all have become angry or caused trouble, in our life. And none of us get out of this life, without some kind of thing, we regret. So, we just have to chalk it up to lack of experience at the time.
They were recent master. Like when I think of them, most of them have between 1 and 3, 4 years of experience.
Yeah.
I know when we do the master training, we think we're there in the first year. We feel as you advance, you realize like actually you have a long way in front of you. It's like so I think also her transition happened when these masters were very fresh and they believed they knew more than they did.
Yeah. They were very young masters at the time. None of them really should have been training other masters, in my opinion. I feel like back in the day, when Takara was learning, you basically learned how to initiate and train people in the first degree. And then you waited a period and you did that. And then after that period, then you learn how to do the second degree initiation and training. And then you start teaching second degree, first and second degree. And then when you have experience doing that, then you were allowed, you were given the authority to train other masters. But, the whole idea of mastery is, that's a topic I'll be discussing in future webinars. And it's going to, mastery means something. So it means you have, a certain level, not just knowledge, but experience. You have experience, a lot of experience, and so, that's why people were trained like that as masters, and Takata trained her early masters the same way. She taught John Harvey Gray, how to do the first degree class initiations. And then she left and she came back 3 months later, after he had time to be teaching and practicing, and then taught him how to do the second, it was a way to pace the student too, because there's a lot of information in the third degree. But it's more than just knowledge, you see. And that's the thing. I think people think, oh, once I learn just how to walk around and wave my hands over students or something, then I know third. And it's like, yeah, that's not really it. That's just like a small part of it. And the practice is where you start learning and teaching. You learn a lot by teaching.
Oh yeah.
So it was kind of nice because back in the day it was more of an apprenticeship. Definitely an apprenticeship. I mean, a lot of her master students in the early days, they would follow her and watch her teach tons of classes and invite her to keep teaching where they lived. Even though they could be teaching, they want to see her teach. Which was great, because every first degree class you teach is different, right? So you say things a different way, or you bring up other topics or other parts of history or emphasize things. So the more time you spend with your teacher, the better. So later in Takata's teaching, she knew she might not get to be back with some of these students, and so she trained, first degree, second degree teacher, how to do those two initiations. But as far as I can tell, she only trained a few how to initiate masters. And so, really two, but, and that was Fran Brown, honestly, Fran Brown and Barbara Weber. And I'm not sure. It's unclear right now. Sometimes we'll never know if there was the third one was really taught. The apprenticeship route was the original kind of way of doing it. And it's slow. It's a slow pace. People are obsessed with speed because they think they can get it, right?
Yeah.
You just do, like I said, you just walk around, wave your arms, whatever. That's not it. There's so much more. There's so much more to it.
And I think that for me is like, it's not like I'm angry or anything. It's like, no, don't cut yourself short. Today I was teaching a Reiki 1 class and I was telling her, like, we oversell the Reiki class and we undersell it at the same time. We offer this magical thing, but we don't talk about the richness of the depth of the practice. So it's very funny. We're doing both things a lot of time when we promote these Reiki classes, power, healing, that we oversell it. But then people practice for a week and that's it or another level and then we let them go versus this is a practice that never stops to surprise you and go deeper and to give you blessings, right? As the precept says.
Right. And
think, how do we change that? Is as you said, like you can only process all these things slowly and go slowly because it's so much step that you will drown in it.
Yeah. I mean, every teacher has to decide, you know, for themselves. And myself, you know, I've always trained masters the slow way. Like I call it the slow way. And that's just my preference. And if somebody wants a weekend thing, fine, they can find another teacher. But like with my first degree students, you know, I mean, that's why I had weekly Reiki shares for them because, you know, the class is just the class. I mean, that's the beginning. But now you got to do the practice so you can see what you were given and see where it leads you. So by making sure we had weekly Reiki shares that students could attend, they would come back and they would practice. They would practice there. They would practice at home more likely because they, once they got a group, and plus then they can interact with the other students, like, you know, about things that come up or questions, you know, you're there to answer the questions with the student. And, you know, it's a supportive thing. So, yeah, I mean, I did that for decades, you know, so it was just, it was really, I think it's an opportunity that people, and if your teacher doesn't have one of those, just create your own.
Yeah.
You know?
And one thing that we're talking in the pre-interview, very interesting. So the first time I saw the $10,000 for the mastership, I was like, no way, I will never pay that, right? And I paid like $1,200 for my first master. And honestly, it was worth every penny and I did it in 3 months. And then when we're talking, first of all, I want you to clarify what is a little bit what you like, what is offered with those 10,000, and then I'll add also my experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the traditional fee was 10,000, which is like 38,000 in today's money. It's a lot of money. And, you know, people think, wow, $10,000, that's crazy. You know, why would anybody pay that? You know, well, the Takata Master students did. And Takata had to pay a fortune. And, you know, that's just, it was part of the tradition. And part of it was going way back to the Sui's time. You know, even the school, the Gakkai, the Sui Kai now, they had high fees, you know. And in fact, in some of the like 1920s newspaper, you know, there was that article saying, man, this is Sui school, you know, has such high fees, you know, like what's that about, you know? So people are always complaining about the fees. But the point of the fee, I mean, there's a lot of great lessons when people contemplate the fees, but $10,000, at first you think it's a lot of money. But, you know, when you start really thinking about it, you know, what are we getting in the training? And it's not just, like I said, waving your hands around. It's a mind shift too. It's a different way of looking at things rather than looking at $10,000. It's like, whoa, this is a lot of money. You can look at it differently, like a challenge. Instead of just saying, I can't do that or I don't want to do that, you can be like, how can I do that? You know, you just shift your mind. How can I do it? And it really makes you think, do I want to do it? You know, that's one of the lessons. Like when you say $10,000, just see who just immediately shuts down and just doesn't even try to come up with any possible way. If they really want something, they'll do it. That's pretty much what I found. I mean, people back then, like Rick Bochner and a bunch of these master students that did this training, they didn't have lots of money. They didn't have like, there was like a lot of money to them too. And they didn't have it, you know, but they decided, you know what, I'm going to work for it. I'm going to make sure every dime I can scrounge, I'm going to save it so I can give that to Mrs. Takata. And then Takata also had a way that students could pay, which was like put down, like Bethel Fay, she was going to borrow money from a friend, but it turned out that friend at the last minute said, oh, I don't have it. Oops, you know, so Beth only had half, she had 5,000, and she asked Mr. Takata, hey, instead of just saying, I don't have the money, right? She could have just said to Takata, I don't have the money, my friend backed up. She didn't say that. She said, I have half of it, and I'll teach Reiki classes, and I'll send you all the money that I was earning from the Reiki classes until I pay 10,000. And that was not the only time something like that was done, or people set up classes for Mrs. Takata to teach. And the student's tuition would be deducted off the $10,000. So there are ways that Takata had that would empower students who really wanted it. You know, I mean, setting up a class, you know, these students would be setting up classes of like 30 people sometimes. That's a lot of effort if you've ever tried to set up classes before to get like 30 students. And then that's just for first degree. So it's like, there were ways, but the 10,000 also really isn't that much if you think about what we're trying to teach people with. It's just mastery, which is mastery, not just a Reiki master, but mastery in your life, where you set your mind to something, and people call it manifestation, you know, but you set your mind to something, and then the universe really does conspire to help you along. But start thinking about 10,000. It's like, well, back then, and, you know, second degree was 500.
More than
so
that.
So are you telling me $500? So like, are you telling me like in the entire career, if you're going to re-teaching Reiki, you're not going to teach 20 students? That's only 20 students. So no longer is it $10,000. It's 20 second degree students. And before they get to second degree, they had to go to first degree, which is at the end of Takata's life, $150. So really, I mean, it's not a lot of students. It's not, you know, it's not a lot. So the whole number 10,000, it means like all things. I mean, there's like a lot of symbolism,
yeah.
But it's supposed to be a lot. It's supposed to be a lot because of many reasons. But like I said, one is just an immediate challenge to the student. Where are they with their relationship to money? Are they in the poverty mindset? Or are they in the abundance mindset? And so the abundance mindset, people, like I said, will say, how can I do this? How can I do it? Not, I can't do that. Without even trying to put in one little effort, within a split second, they decide they can't do it. Yeah, I don't want students like that. I want students who are determined, you know. And then Takata did too, you know.
I think there are a couple of things I find very interesting. First of all, I'm going to just clarify for the people who have done master training a day that 10,000 includes like, you know, mentoring, like almost like a year or 2 years of training. So,
right.
You know, so understand that. But I think also, for example, in my dojo, there is a filter. Everybody could join. My dojo is for martial arts is very cheap. So they put a big signing fee up of like $300, which for, you know, martial arts and the idea of the fee is to actually weed the people out that don't really want to do it, because most of the training and the time of the sensei is the first 2-3 months where they have to teach everything. And then if they have to do that with all the people who drop after a month, it's not worth it. So the big signing up fee is almost like a filter, like, do you really want to commit to do
Yeah.
Iago?
Right.
And I think and I'm the one who actually went the other way, right? I paid like $1,200 for my first master training. And then, as I mentioned to you, I repeated so many that I probably am closer to 15,000 than 10.
Right, exactly.
And then every penny's been worth. Like,
right.
But, you know, it's a filter. But also, as I'm hearing you, it's like one of the challenges as masters. First of all, we think we're ready. Then we do the class, $1,000. We waste it because we didn't feel that we were not ready. We just were like, oh, more power, we go. But the second thing, the way you're putting it, if I have to look for students, also develop the capacity to get students so I can pay you, which
right.
is the biggest challenge. We get a Reiki master and they're like, no way. I'm like, I don't know how to get students. So you do the part that is the biggest challenge that you realize, actually, I don't want to have a Reiki business.
Right.
I don't want to be a Reiki teacher before you spend the money.
Right.
So it's quite, I never seen it like that. And I really appreciate changing my perspective on it, you know?
Yeah. And I taught where if students, like my current students, would be set up a class, I would deduct that amount off that $10,000 fee. And see, you're teaching the student, you're teaching that second degree student how to, you know, set up a class. Yeah. You know, they might not understand it at the time, but see, that's already part of the training. And there's a lot of stuff we do that, you know, in first degree that we're training them for second degree. And they don't know it. They just don't know it, you know, but it's a stepping, you know, it's like these progressions, like in first degree, you know, we put our hands down and we're just aware. We're just simply resting our awareness on our hands. And for so many people, that's so challenging because they think they got to do something. I got to do something, you know? And it's like, what we're doing is we're training them in meditation. We're training them in mindfulness. Yeah. Because when we move on to second degree, you're going to need it. Because once we start doing like the mental treatment, you know, when we do a mental treatment in second degree, anything you're thinking, there's a certain way to do mental treatments. There's like several methods. There's one in particular to kind of stop teaching eventually, because maybe it was too challenging for students. But anything you're thinking goes directly into that person's subconscious mind. So you have to already have the skill of being in that present moment, retaining your mindfulness of being there. So you're not thinking about other stuff, because whatever you're thinking, it's going to go in there. And this is one of the big lessons in that Takata taught, that Reiki is Reiki. Reiki is neutral. You know, people think, oh, Reiki can do no harm on stuff. Well, the practices that we teach our students does no harm. But when we move into second degree, this is an advanced degree. We have to then allow for the students to progress like to this mindfulness to teach them this particular technique. But the other thing is, going back to what Takata said, that Reiki is neutral. It's not good or bad. Energy is just energy. It's like sunshine. You know, it's not good or bad. It feels good, but if you get too much, you get burned, right? Water, it's good for you. If you drink too much, you can actually die. You know, so that's what Reiki is. And so she wouldn't allow, I mean, there's all sorts of stories, but she wouldn't allow certain ages into her classes. Usually it's around age 10 and up, because before that, their energetic system, children's energetic system, isn't well developed enough to handle the initiation process. Yeah, it can create damage. These are her words. So I'm saying there are some big misunderstandings with the Reiki system of how it was later kind of passed on, where Takata's like, hey, the way we practice, as long as you follow this method, everything's fine. But Asui, he knew how to use Reiki like we learn it mostly today, and he knew how to use it more offensively, you know, energetically attack. So because it's just energy, and you can use it for good or other purposes. But we teach it, so that's why we say it's Asui Shiki Reiki Ryoho. This is the system that Asui wanted passed down. And some of the other techniques were passed down, but we only pass them down to maintain the knowledge, not to, you know, abuse anything. So, but yeah, it's a big thing. But like I said, going back, we're training students, like second degree students who want to do teacher training. It's a long process, you know, it's a couple years usually. Students have always followed me around, watched me teach classes, help me teach during the classes. I tell them what part they're going to teach. So they're getting all this experience during their training. And, you know, it takes so long. It really wouldn't, you know, be worth, if you break it all down, like per day, it's actually, they're not paying that much to be in constant contact. And they're helping me out in clinic, you know, when I'm treating general public with Reiki treatments. You know, a lot of times I would team treat with my students to let them have more experience.
And I think also Reiki 3 has become commoditized, like versus understanding this is a commitment of going deeper into your practice for life. This is not even like a teaching, like teaching level. It's really a, it's called mystery teachings, right? In Japanese, it's like, it's a commitment to something deeper. So I think also, again, that filter sometimes I'm like, you have no idea. I go everywhere and they are master, like Reiki masters everywhere, right?
Right.
And when I took my class, Reiki 1 and Reiki 2, in the same weekend, they told me you can do Reiki Master next weekend.
Right. And, you know, those kind of masters that come out, I mean, and that's where I decided to stop calling, you know, I struggled for years with this, yeah. You know, this idea because, you know, mastery means something to me. And so... And I've told people, and even in my book, you know, I write, I can't make you a Reiki master, you know? You know, what I can do, as I basically make you a Reiki teacher, you know? And that's the difference. Like, and I think, you know, I really had this shift a little while ago. I'm like, I think I'm going to really stress that a lot, that we train Reiki teachers, you know? And it's totally up to you. It's up to the student to become a master. I mean... That's, you know, no matter how many times I've said it before, I think it's better maybe to even on the certificate, you yeah. know, have Reiki teacher. Because when you first learn how to teach first degree, right, you've not mastered that. But you're just now starting, you know, so it takes years to become a master and a lot of experience. So I feel like, for myself, and I mean, if other people feel called too, you know, I hope that's like a trend that will be, you know, first degree, second degree, and we call it third degree, but the third degree can be broken down like first degree teacher, second degree teacher, you know, third degree teacher, you know, but mastery is something else, you know?
Yeah. I don't use any master or master certificate. I'm like, you completed Shimpinden training. I'm not even saying like, that's it. You did a Shimpinden training, which is level 3, and that's as much as I'm giving you as a certificate, right? And I really appreciate that. And also, I think a lot of Shimpinden trainees or Reiki master, whatever you want to call it, they teach you the attunement, but they don't teach you how to teach. And I think also that's the difference when you're doing, especially in your lineage, like they're training with you. They've been for 2 years. I learned teaching because I did a bunch of dry runs for free with friends.
Right.
And actually, I realized everything that I did wrong, right? And I did that until I feel, okay, now I can teach. And now I'm realizing intuitively I did that. I did Reiki 1 for years. Then I added Reiki 2. And I started Reiki 3 like way after, right? Like way after.
Right.
And my first, right? Like my first one was like, this is the first time I teach. So like be aware of it, right? So I think we also have to be honest of where we are.
Right.
And communicating. And in your case, you have almost 30 years of experience, right? So like there obviously it's going to be a different experience to train with you, and there is no better or worse. It's just more or less experience. Like it's not, if you did that Reiki training that I did, Reiki 1, Reiki 2, I ended up in a different place. So it was a great way for me to get in.
Right.
We're not also diminished. You may do your Reiki master and everything in a month, then take your time to practice and maybe you're going to go deeper, right? I think what we're saying is whatever way you were trained, just practice.
Yeah, just practice. And that's the thing. And that's the thing. I mean, like some people, you know, they come to Reiki, they get a lot of training right off the bat. Maybe they went 1, 2, 3 in a weekend, you know, and, you know, but some of those students will know, like, they'll practice and they'll realize, you know, something you can intuit that something's missing or something, there's more or I don't know, just since something doesn't sit right. So those are the students that will, one, keep practicing, but two, go looking. See, yeah. They'll start looking actively, not just take the class because the person who they took class from lived in the same city or whatever. I mean, these students are the serious ones, and they'll start traveling to make sure, or they'll bring the teacher to them. They will put forth that dedication to find the right teacher for them. And you know, that's a whole ordeal too. You got to find the right teacher or teachers, you know, for yourself, because everybody has different experiences. Everybody teaches a little bit different, but you know, gotta find what works for you, what resonates with you, because it's your path. It's your path.
I love how empowering that sounded. So I have another question, because we have this wonderful conversation. And when I look at you, I'm like, okay, you have traveled all around the States and Japan and everywhere. You've been with archives. You have so much wisdom and so many years of practice. I will never be able to live up. I just took a Reiki 1 class and I'm listening to this. So obviously, one thing I was teaching today in my Reiki 1 is like, you're going to make mistakes if you practice, because that's part of it, right? So I love to close every interview with that little oops that brought you perhaps actually a big insight, because that's the way we get insights, right? We don't learn. So if you could share one, I would really appreciate it.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, I was thinking of some other stuff when you were talking. Let me address that. You know, when you're teaching students, and these are brand new students, first degree class, never maybe even got a Reiki treatment before, and they hear the teacher talking about all this stuff, and you're right, sometimes they just shut down. They're just like, well, that's never going to be me. I mean, again, there's got to be a mind shift if they do want to practice. It has nothing to do with comparisons. I mean, and that's the one thing we give up is comparing ourselves. Yeah. Because it doesn't help. I mean, because we're different people and we're on our own path. So, and, you know, eventually you come to a place. And that's part, see, that's another reason why I had those Reiki shares. Because students can come and listen to stories. And eventually, if they keep coming, they'll get to a place. Because in the beginning, they're like, oh, this student here feels the energy. And I had all these experiences and I don't have anything. And, you know, but eventually they'll get to a place mentally where they can share and not compare, and they can hear stories from other people and not feel insecure. They just hear it, you know, and they can learn lessons from it. And instead of all of a sudden this defensive emotion runs up or this what do you call it? The lack of confidence, you know, insecurity, you know, that pops up. But, you know, eventually you can share without comparing. But as far as like an oops mistake, that's a good one. I have to think about it. I have to think about it because I'm sure I've made some mistake. I can tell you in the acupuncture clinic, overdid something and decided, oops, I'll never do that again. And I'll tell that story because it's
perfect.
Because that's the one that's coming to my mind. But there's in Chinese medicine, we feel the pulse. So we feel it with three fingers. We feel the pulse and not just beats per minute. You know, there's all sorts of strength and the width of the pulse and how erratic or normal it is. I mean, there's all sorts of things with pulse taking. But anyway, there's a particular type of pulse called a slippery pulse. And a slippery pulse means it's like you got your fingers down. It feels like somebody's pulling a bead of pearls, you know, a string of pearls under. So it's rolling. It's like this slippery pulse. We feel it going like somebody's literally pulling pearl necklace under your fingers. This usually means two things. It means that there's like dampness or phlegm in the body, but also pregnancy. So I treat a lot of women and for infertility. And so, you know, I felt this woman's pulse and she was pregnant and she had the slippery pulse. And, you know, she didn't, of course, know anything. I just felt her pulse and I'm like, oh, you have a slippery pulse. She's like, what does that mean? I'm like, it means you're pregnant, you know. So she was like, okay, well, I never do that again. Because what happened was like a week or two later, I'm not sure, she called me up all frantic that she was bleeding vaginally. And so she was all concerned that she was going to miscarry. And so she wanted me to come to her house and, you know, do a treatment and feel her pulse. And I thought, oh, crap. You know, so I went there. And I felt her pulse. It was not slippery. Oh. What do I say to her? You know, so I try to like be like, well, this isn't definitive. You know, I try to like, you know, it's I knew the pulse wasn't slippery anymore. Yeah. But I realized at that point, never again will I overshare, you know, why I'm feeling that pulse, for instance, because I don't want to ever be put in that position because, and she did miscarry and, you know, but I can't even legally tell her, oh, you're going to miscarry, you know, like, so I put myself in a very bad bind by oversharing some information. And so I know how I teach Reiki, and I think I can't give you specifics, but I tell students in the class, like in first degree, I will give you first degree stories. And in second degree, I will give you second degree stories. And what I mean by that is in first degree, I'll try to keep all the stories, you know, pretty simple and basic and nothing like too, you know, fantastic. Because sometimes, like I said, the student's mind isn't open for it yet. You know, they hear those stories and they'll be like, I can never do that, you know, or whatever, right? Or, you know, this person's just special or something. It's like, no. So, you know, I don't think so. Talk to my wife. So, you know, you have to be, you know, when we share stories in first degree, I basically tell first degree stories. And in second degree, they'll believe almost anything you tell them because they've already have all this practice and experience to them that they're like, whoa, like this, like all sorts of stuff has happened if they practice long enough. And they're like, wow, you know, so they're open now to hear stories and, you know, actually have them, the stories land somewhere in them. So, and same with third degree. So yeah, I think that's kind of like the gist of, like, I would say what I learned.
I actually appreciate those because when you start talking, it's also sometimes we overshare what we felt in a session to the person. Yeah. And honestly, being a little bit more silent may be better. Sometimes we need people to process their own emotion, their own feeling. So I know it was acupuncture, but I think actually it was a very, very beautiful learning for Reiki as well. So that's why it popped up in your head, because we don't talk very much about how we share stories as teacher or messages or, you know, I personally have a policy like the least I won't share very much.
Right.
Unless, because they're doing their own healing, right? And I may be sharing something that I'm not meant to.
Right. That's exactly right. Yes. That's me too.
Yes. Right.
That's how I am. People will come to Reiki treatment and, you know, sometimes they'll want to hear, well, what did you feel? And I, even if I got messages and stuff, unless I get them three times and it just keeps bugging me, I won't tell them.
Yeah. Three times.
I won't tell them because, you know, I'll just say, oh, this area took more energy. And they'll be like, well, what does that mean? I'm like, that area needs more energy there. You know, I keep it very, because I'm not there, you know, to do that. I'm not there to give them a psychic reading. I'm there to simply do the Reiki treatment. And plus you could freak people out. In fact, that's another Reiki story where I was teaching a class and I was like just running my hand over somebody's leg. And, you know, I got all this pain in my bone. And so when I feel the Reiki, you know, we can tell sometimes where the injury was. Like if it's in our skin, you know, it's pretty surface. If it's a muscular injury, we'll feel our muscles. If it's a bone like problem, like it was broken, we'll feel ache in our bones. And it's not us taking on that person's bad energy. It's like just the way we're receiving it so we can understand how Reiki's communicating. So I had my hand over the leg of this woman and I was like, son of a, it hurt, my bones hurt. And I said, did you break this leg at some point? And it freaked her out. She had broken that area, but it was like 10 years ago. And I'm like, oh, and I said, well, you know, it's obviously healed because she's not limping or anything. You know, I didn't know anything about it. I said, but physically it healed, but on an energetic level, something didn't heal all the way. Otherwise, I wouldn't pick it up. But that kind of spooked her that, you know, people can, I don't know, either be that sensitive or know things that are so unapparent. But anybody can do that, you know, it just comes with practice and experience. That's it. But you can't freak people out. So we tend to keep our mouth shut. I keep my mouth shut now during treatment.
I do, and it's funny because I'm like, unless it comes three times and it really knocks on my head.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I try to do it very positively, very, I mostly keep like, oh, we work a lot of like, we release tension here, we allow things to move. I'm very general. Yeah. And I ask them, how did I feel? So, and I think actually that is very wise advice, because sometimes we do get something that we have to say.
Yeah. Right. True.
It happens. But I never thought about like being careful about freaking people out in classes. And I think that's also a good watch out. I'll keep it in mind as well. You know, some people are like, because in our classes, we get some people who are very into like, I want to see angels flying, miracles, to believe in Reiki. And then we got the skeptic who are like, you know, we have a mix of people. Like, it's not like we have one. Well, I teach a lot of one-on-one, so I do, because I like that experience of adapting teachings. But, you know, sometimes you have, I remember I taught a class with five people. They were like the five most opposite people that you could have. So keep it safe, right? And keep it.
Yeah. Keep it. You know, like I said, first degree stories and first degree and
broken leg.
Yeah. Just like, okay, this takes a lot of energy here. And if she reveals, oh, I broke that, then fine. But don't be like, hey, did you break this? Yeah, that doesn't go over so well sometimes.
So last thing, you're going to develop a poker face when you're demonstrating, because sometimes you're demonstrating on people and yeah, you may have that very strong hibiki sensation in your hands. And you have to keep on going, because if not, they're going to be scared to place their hands because it may be painful, right? And it's just what pain means is place your hands longer. It doesn't mean.
That's anything. Right. Yeah, keep your hands there longer.
That's it. Right.
Like, until the sensation stops, yeah.
Yeah, some people don't like to throw in me because like, what does that mean? Place your hands longer. Well, how do I deepen my practice? Sit on your butt, practice. Like, it sounds like I'm basic, but I, you know, which is why we're having so much fun.
Yeah, that's right. That's so funny.
Beyond this interview, which I'm beyond grateful, that book, I really highly recommend it. I'm going to put a link on the podcast, because I think a lot of time I come from like, again, your what they call a traditional Japanese lineage, with all these are misnomers, to be honest, because my practice is a little closer to yours, who's like Takata practice. We're actually very close. Yeah. And I think a lot of time I saw Takata Reiki as like something different because of my training that was supposed to be Takata. So I really encourage everyone. Your book has a lot of richness. The way she describes Usui stories is very beautiful, especially the part about also like the part when Usui goes, which supposedly is invented, when he goes to the poor camp, the people, the beggars camp.
Yeah.
But they have a lot of beautiful teachings for everyone. And all the work that you put into it, I wanted you to know that I know you invested a lot of time, money, and was part of your goal to do that. I just want you to know we're so thankful. It was really, I really enjoyed that book. It really was like, wow, you know. And I've read a lot of Reiki books, as you can imagine, because I've read like a ton of books.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So we're really grateful for you and for you coming here. And I'll be posting your link for your website. Again, I love acupuncture, so people in Kentucky, they can get whatever they want as well. You're supposed to make people laugh. I actually love the feeling of the needles coming into my skin. It's a very strange thing. I love it.
And it's very relaxing.
It's lovely. It's just like you feel your body, like it brings me to my body, which is not my strength. Anything that I didn't ask you that you would like to add before we?
No, just encourage. I'm just going to encourage people like I always do to practice. Just practice, practice, practice.
Perfect. That is the perfect final words. I'm not going to add beyond thank you. And thank everyone, you. Just read the notes for more information about your wonderful practice and books. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Dive into Reiki podcast. You can read a full transcript of today's interview at diveintoreiki.com/blog. If you found this episode helpful, please hit the subscribe button, leave me a review, or just share it with your friends. It makes all the difference. Thank you. Gracias. Merci.